Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. So good to have you with us, as also our experts, our political analysts. Jonathan Hasid is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science in our Ames studio in the Political Science Department at Iowa State University. Jonathan, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Rene Rocha is with us. Rene is he's the Director of Latino Studies at the University of Iowa, where he is also Associate Professor of Political Science. Rene, welcome back to you.
Good to be with you, Ben.
And we'll be looking at your various expertise here, inviting our listeners to call. Join our conversation, 1-800-235-2665. I guess that's the pledge drive call number. You can email us, 866-780-9100, to participate in this conversation about politics. Well, we had a long list. We do have a long list of political developments to look at. John Kelly's legacy, the search for a new White House chief of staff, how the next attorney general could impact the Mueller investigation, among those. But our list got longer just a few minutes ago when the breaking news came through that Michael Cohen, the former lawyer for President Trump, has been sentenced to 3 years in prison just a bit ago for his role in the scandal, sentencing in a court in Manhattan. Mr. Cohen, 52 years old, had once thought he would be by President Trump's side in the White House, but his ending up to be a central figure in this look into payments to a porn star and a former Playboy model before the 2016 election. Before we move on, I'd like to get your reactions to this breaking news. Jonathan Hasid, let me start with you.
Well, you know, it certainly isn't good news for the president. I mean, now we've had convictions or guilty pleas from the president's campaign manager, his deputy campaign manager, his personal attorney, his national security advisor, other hangers-on, and assorted shady figures in the president's orbit. And you know, none of this directly implicates the president in any kind of, any kind of Russian-related malfeasance. Cohen said that he directed illegal campaign contributions at the president's behest. For those who are still waiting for a connection to any kind of Russian shenanigans, we'll have to wait a little bit longer. But, you know, for someone who claims to have only hired the best people, he certainly surrounded himself with a lot of criminals.
Right. And yesterday in our news, lawyers for Michael Flynn, that was Trump's first national security advisor, asked a judge to spare him prison time, suggesting that FBI agents who interviewed him last year had tricked him into lying. Revelations come once, twice a day in this Mueller investigation. Your reaction to the latest, Rene?
Yeah, I wonder what the actual effect of this will be. It certainly adds to a long list of seemingly troubled stories for the president, but what are the ultimate consequences? He isn't in immediate legal jeopardy, at least if the Department of Justice sticks with their idea of not indicting a sitting president. And I think the prospect of impeachment is remote, even if the Cohen investigation revealed things which some might consider grounds for impeachment, such as that violation of campaign finance laws with those payments. The House seems very hesitant to do it. Will the conviction hurt his approval rating? Will it hurt his standing amongst Republicans? That also seems unlikely, given the fact that he's absorbed many other negative stories. And so while it's certainly not a positive development for the president, I wonder if he actually has any sort of long-lasting negative effects from what's going on. The one consideration might be that as the investigation proceeds, if it eventually gets people even closer in his orbit, such as immediate family members, will that make him behave in such a way which is problematic for him on a level that we haven't seen yet?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about a related matter. The next attorney general, William Barr, is the president's pick to be the next AG to lead the Justice Department. Once again, he did back in the early 90s. That would put him in charge, of course, of this federal probe into the Russian election interference. If confirmed by the Senate, he would take over from Matthew Whitaker, who's been serving in an acting capacity since President Trump forced out Jeff Sessions about a month ago. What do you think of this pick, Rene, with William Barr? He's been there before. I think I'm seeing that our political leaders, the GOP, say, why not confirm him again? Senator Grassley, I believe, if I'm quoting him correctly, said he passed muster back then. Why shouldn't he pass muster now?
Yeah, I mean, replacing Matthew Whitaker, University of Iowa political science alumni, I'll feel the need to point out. I think, is chosen in part because his public statements have actually been very unfavorable towards the Mueller investigation. And I think the president believes he's somebody who at least his instinct will be to help protect him in that regard. The appointment has a lot of other implications for legislative proposals that I think have not been fully explored. Mitch McConnell just said the other day that he was willing to consider advancing criminal justice reform. As Attorney General, Barr signed off on a book that was produced by the DOJ called The Case for Mass Incarceration. And was actually sort of one of the more punitive sort of attorney generals we've had in recent years, very instrumental in the escalation on the war on drugs, argued that there was not any sort of normative problems with the disparate sentences between crack and powdered cocaine, they were producing racial inequalities in the federal inmate population. And so he seems like somebody who's very unsympathetic to the idea of criminal justice reform. And if that person becomes a very central player in the Trump administration, the question is, will he convince the president to sort of change his tune on criminal justice reform, which the president thus far has been seeming willing to engage?
Right. And we saw the Senate, Mitch McConnell, the leader there, say that that is on the lame duck session agenda as it comes to a close. Criminal justice reform. Back to the implications for the Mueller investigation. William Barr, the president's pick here, Jonathan, has, I'm seeing, said in the past, there's more reason to investigate potential wrongdoing by Trump's campaign opponent, Hillary Clinton, than there is to probe any potential collusion. Your thoughts on the effect for the Mueller investigation here, possibly?
I mean, I would be hard pressed to imagine that Barr would shut down the Mueller investigation, but he may be able to sort of limit its scope. I mean, this is someone who's clearly eminently qualified to be Attorney General. I mean, he's done it before, but one who has an expansive view of executive power, and one who, of course, as you've said, has been critical of the investigation up until now. I think it does sort of showcase, in a certain sense, the weakness of the president's personal network, right? This is not, as far as I know, this is not someone with whom he's had a personal relationship or as any kind of Trump loyalist, but is someone who's been a longtime GOP stalwart. And so it shows that once again, when sort of the president's bench is thin, right, and he has to go back to sort of mainstream GOP figures to fill out the, heavy number of vacancies in his administration.
Mm-hmm. Let's skip over to some of the other major news. There's so much here to have you comment on, Jonathan and Renee. Let's go to the Saudi Arabia controversy. Today, I understand the CIA director, Gina Haspel, briefs House leaders, perhaps has already, about what U.S. intelligence knows about the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. This comes amid those growing questions about what will the Trump administration do in response to the killing. We've had news reports of Jared Kushner's, the president's son-in-law, his relationship to the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Haspel's trip to Capitol Hill today comes a week approximately after her briefing, that briefing we remember from last week, right? Key senators, GOP senators emerging incensed, accusing the president's administration of downplaying the Crown Prince's involvement. Jonathan, I'm wondering what you think of this. Before you do, let's play a little bit of the dissection of the problem facing the administration by our own U.S. Senator Joni Ernst. She spoke at Politico's Women Rule Summit earlier this week. She responded to the death of this Washington Post columnist, Jamal Khashoggi, noting the importance of maintaining U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's involvement in the Yemeni civil war.
We cannot overlook that we have lost a man to horrible, horrible human rights violations. He was outright murdered. Mm-hmm. We know that. So what we have to do and what those consequences are, I see as right now separate from the discussion of the Saudis and their actions in Yemen engaging the Houthis. And let me tell you, the no vote the other week, we are engaged in peace talks between Saudi and the Houthi rebels. And that discussion just started last week. And the United States was very instrumental in getting those two parties to the table to start those peace talks. So engaging in a discussion of pulling U.S. presence out of that region and not engaging puts those peace talks at jeopardy, in my mind.
Okay, Jonathan Haseeb, what do you think of the way U.S. Senator Ernst portrays the challenge to our foreign policy there?
I would look at the challenge a different way. I mean, it's pretty clear that the senators who were briefed by the CIA, as well as others who are privy to the inside information, conclude unequivocally that Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, ordered the assassination and was in direct contact with the assassins before and after it was carried out in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And the president has just flat out rejected this, right? The president keeps saying that he's talked to the Saudi Crown Prince, and the Saudi Crown Prince has denied it, and that's good enough for him. And I think, once again, it showcases a kind of a divide between the president and other members of the executive branch. We've seen similar things with Vladimir Putin, where the administration has, in its formal documents, said that, you know, Russia is responsible for election hacking, but, of course, the president refuses to accept that. And so it seems to me that the administration is likely to do nothing mm-hmm. about this. It's going to continue to support the Saudis. We're going to continue to sell arms and precision and weaponry to the Saudi Air Force and this kind of thing in their bombing campaign. But, you know, it seems to me that the sort of more interesting divide is sort of inside the administration itself, between the professionals on the one hand and the president and his circle of advisors who, for whatever reason, whether it's business ties or personal ties or other reasons, just sort of refuses to accept the assessment of the intelligence community.
Right. And we have Secretary of State Mike Pompeo telling lawmakers, this was last week, there was no direct evidence linking the Crown Prince to the murder. Then, as you pointed out, these divides within the GOP ranks. Lindsey Graham, the Republican senator from South Carolina, saying after his hearing from Haspel that one would have to be willfully blind to deny that MBS was intimately involved. Why not, Jonathan, simply make the case that however horrendous this murder is, and it is on the most horrendous end of the horrendous spectrum, I think all realize that there's simply too many foreign policy interests wrapped up with Saudi Arabia and our interests there. Why not make that case?
I mean, it would certainly be a reasonable argument to make. You know, the U.S. has been in bed with the Saudi regime for decades, and of course we get oil out of it and potentially stability in the Middle East. So someone could easily make that claim, right? But that's not the claim the president is making. The president is simply saying, I don't believe it. I don't believe my own CIA. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why the president just doesn't make that argument, doesn't say that we need the Saudis, that this is unfortunate, but that, you know, we our relationship is too deep to wreck over one incident. But to date, he hasn't made that statement.
Mm-hmm. Now, the slain Washington Post journalist Khashoggi and other journalists were named by Time magazine, called the guardians, Time magazine's Person of the Year for 2018. Khashoggi, representing that group of journalists, chosen over the other candidates, Special Counsel Mueller, the Russian President Putin, also President Trump. Those were the finalists, I'm reading. Mr. Trump named runner-up on Tuesday. I mean, Time magazine, we have to look at, you mentioned Vladimir Putin, Jonathan. Journalists are who are critical of the Kremlin in that country especially have to be concerned.
Sure. I mean, there are lots of examples of Russian journalists having odd poisonings or throwing themselves out of balconies or, you know, being assassinated in other strange ways. So, yes, the Vladimir Putin's administration is one of the world's top killers of journalists. And certainly, you know, this isn't just a Saudi issue. But again, that's another area where the president has refused to condemn the president of Russia directly for whatever reason.
Okay, Jonathan Haseeb is with us. We'll be back after a short break. Iowa State University. Rene Rocha is Director of Latina and Latino Studies, also political science faculty member at the University of Iowa. When we come back, wow, we'll talk about that spectacle in the Oval Office that was open to the press yesterday. 17 minutes of sparring before the news cameras. over the effectiveness of the southern border wall, at times fact-checking, speaking over one another. Unprecedented in the way that was played out. We'll be back to get Renee's and Jonathan's view on that. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
And we're glad to have you on board on this special pledge drive edition of River to River Politics Wednesday with Rene Rocha, Director of Latina and Latino Studies at the University of Iowa, where he's also on the faculty and the political science department. Jonathan Hasid is well with us on the political science faculty at Iowa State University, as we love to do on Wednesdays, our tradition to pick apart the recent politics and the recent flood of political developments is a better description. We'll try to march through as much as we can to get analysis as much as we can before the end of the hour. If you'd like to join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about this spectacle yesterday, Jonathan and Renee, in the White House Oval Office. Donald Trump arguing with Representative Nancy Pelosi, Senator Chuck Schumer in front of reporters, 17 minutes long, sparring before news cameras over the effectiveness of a southern border wall, at times fact-checking, speaking over one another, the president blocking full funding for the government if Democrats refuse to allocate money for his long-proposed wall on the southern border. Let's get a sense. This is about a minute from the very end of that 17 minutes where the president takes responsibility for any potential shutdown. Listen to this mix-up.
One thing I think we can agree on is we shouldn't shut down the government over a dispute. And you want to shut it down.
The last time, Chuck, you shut it down.
No.
And then you opened it up very quickly. And
20 times.
I don't want to do what you did.
20 times,
Chuck,
you have called for, I will shut down the government if I don't get my wool. None of us have
said.
You
want to know something?
You've said it.
Okay, you want to put that
on my... You've said it.
I'll take it.
Okay, good.
You know what I'll say? Yes. If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, whether it's through you, through a military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay,
absolutely.
Fair enough.
And
we
I am
disagree.
Proud, and I'll
we
tell
disagree.
You what, I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it. The last time you shut it down, it didn't work. I will take the mantle
good.
Of shutting down.
That is
and
lovely.
I'm going to shut it down for border
security.
But
we security. Believe you shouldn't
okay.
shut it down.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Okay, so much in that 17 minutes. That was about the last minute of it. So much to unpack there. But one of the big things, the president breaking with political convention Rene, by owning a shutdown, which you don't like to do you?
Yeah, and I think you may feel it's a little bit safer this time around. Actually, it would be a partial shutdown at best. The Congress has allocated funds for a large portion of the federal government, all essential services, so it would be a little bit less dramatic than maybe some of the shutdowns that occurred during the Clinton administration. He's left himself a little bit of an out in that discussion. You know, he said we would shut down the government if he couldn't secure the border via a wall, via the military, via something else. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe he can say, well, even if I don't get the $5 billion in border wall funding that I want, I've decided via my, you know, strong executive action to send more troops there and secure it that way. And therefore, he's comfortable. But we'll see how it progresses. Both sides have certainly dug in their heels. And I'm not quite sure how either one of them claw their way back from that.
Jonathan, what are your takeaways from what we saw yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, certainly now both sides are dug in, right? Nancy Pelosi, of course, is trying to be the next Speaker of the House, and she needs support from the more liberal members of her caucus to get her the votes to be Speaker. And if she or Chuck Schumer back down now, it will be she may not be able to be Speaker of the House. And the president certainly, as we've heard, has owned the issue outright. It seems to me a sort of a strange hill to die on for the president, in the sense that although the border wall is popular among his base, it's not very popular among Americans nationally. Mm. The polling I've seen recently suggests that about twice as many Americans don't consider the wall an important issue as those who do. Of course, there's a partisan split on this.
Right.
But it may be that in playing to his base, the president then is associated with all of these images of government shutdown, which help him further among independents. and moderates with whom he's already losing ground. So, I don't really know what the end game is here. It seems to me that the president may well have been outmaneuvered here. So there are reports that after this meeting was over that the president was very angry in the Oval Office and apparently threw his briefing book to the side. I mean, you know, these are uncorroborated reports. But if that's the case, it suggests that the president may well be aware that he was outmaneuvered here.
That the optics were not good, and he could immediately recognize that.
That's right, and a lot of Republican senators who were approached after this seemed to be pretty queasy about the whole thing. You know, in general, you don't want to own a shutdown, right? You want to blame it on your opponent. That's now going to be difficult for the president to do.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a little bit more of that spectacle in the Oval Office yesterday. Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, President, Vice President Mike Pence there, but the only news that he made was there. He didn't say a word, sat there between Trump and Pelosi in silence the whole time. Let's listen to Representative Pelosi challenging President Trump's belief that he had the votes needed to pass a budget in the House and the Senate.
It doesn't help to take that vote because I'm not going to get the vote of the Senate. I need 10 senators. That's the problem.
Mr. President, you have the White House. You have the Senate.
I have the White House. The White House is done, and the House would give me the vote if I wanted it, but I can't because I need, Nancy, I need 10 votes from Chuck.
All right, let me say something here.
Let me just say one thing. The fact is, you do not have the votes in the House.
Nancy, I do, and we need border security. Nancy, we need border security. It's very simple.
Of course we do.
We need border security. People are pouring into our country, including terrorists. We have terrorists. We caught 10 terrorists over the last very short period of time. 10. These are very serious people. Our border agents, all of our law enforcement has been incredible what they've done. But we caught 10 terrorists. These are people that were looking to do harm.
Okay, a little excerpt from the melee yesterday in the Oval Office. And as with many things connected to this president, we have to pay attention to fact-checking here. I looked at the PolitiFact, the Pulitzer Prize-winning PolitiFact website on this, and there were numerous corrections there. We heard incorrect statements, falsehoods there stated by the president, didn't we, Renee?
Yeah, I mean, the idea that we've apprehended 10 terrorists is a number, within a very short period of time, is a number that doesn't quite fit with regular trends. The number of people that the Department of Homeland Security actually apprehends that have terrorist connections, you know, it might be around 10 to 20 in any given year if you look at some of the more recent years. He made some other statements about individuals coming and bringing disease and other sort of very heavily racialized and stigmatized statements that are also, you know, just not grounded in fact. You know, there's a couple of other things that are going on in that clip. And one is that distinction between border security and the wall. And the wall has become this really highly symbolic issue mm-hmm. for the president. But it's not clear that it's the most effective way of securing the border. And also within the discussion there, both of Speaker-to-be Pelosi, Senator Schumer, and President Trump is the idea that we need more border security, that the border is somehow very insecure right now. Which also is something which is very difficult to understand given the significant increases in money that's been allocated towards border security over the past couple of cycles. And, you know, the idea that we really need this $5 billion, where does this $5 billion number come from? The head of Customs and Border Protection was on Capitol Hill just this week. Congress has already allocated $1.5 billion for the erection of border barrier. This is where we get into that distinction between what's a fence, what's a barrier, mm-hmm. you know, sort of what's a wall. And the head of the Border Patrol reported that of the $1.5 billion that has been allocated, they've spent most of it, and they've gotten 33 miles out of a 40-mile plan of border barrier erected.
And
the president wants to build a wall over 1,100 miles. With so it's not clear how $5 billion gets us, you know, significantly towards that goal.
So Jonathan Haseeb, so this has to do with, you know, just naming, is it a border wall? Are we interested in a border wall specifically or border security? Can the president budge and accept, for instance, Chuck Schumer said yesterday, experts say you can do this without a wall, right? Jonathan, I don't know. We don't have the expertise here, perhaps, to judge that.
Right, but the studies that have come out, say from the Department of Homeland Security in the past, suggest that a physical wall is not an effective barrier at keeping people out. You know, I'm a China specialist, and the Chinese famously built a very long wall, and it didn't stop any invaders from coming in. And so the idea that, you know, a wall here would be the answer is pretty silly. Now, of course, it is the president's signature issue, and so it's pretty clear that, you know, he wants to stand in front of a section of the wall, however long it is, if it's only 33 miles, and say, you know, this is what we've done, right? This is my big, glorious wall. And it's equally clear that the Democrats want to deny him that opportunity. And so there's a, you know, really a fundamental disconnect here. Neither, you know, basically neither side wants to budge, and both sides cannot get what they want. This is an issue on which is essentially impossible to meet in the middle.
Okay, we'll see what happens as we are in the day nine of the countdown, to the deadline to keep the government open. And the president saying $5 billion for the wall must be included in the spending package there. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Ben Kiefer with Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University and Rene Rocha of the University of Iowa. Well, the president says he has 10 to 12 candidates he's considering for the post of the new White House Chief of Staff. He says, though, although he could move quickly to fill the job, he's in no particular rush. Trump's current chief of staff, retired General John Kelly, leaving at the beginning of the new year. Some potential candidates, Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, I guess offering some polite no thank yous there. He says, the president says, I'm no trouble recruiting people for one of the most powerful jobs in Washington. Rene, how would you characterize this search for a chief of staff? And remind us, too, that's a key figure as we move into a different phase in the president's administration timeline here.
Yeah, well, the chief of staff has historically been a very key figure, but one of the problems and one of the reasons that he's perhaps having trouble finding a replacement is the fact that that person has been seemingly pretty marginalized over the, you know, various candidates that have fulfilled that position over the first 2 years of the Trump administration. A lot of these stories are interrelated. Part of the reason he may be having trouble is related to the Cohen stuff that we were talking about at the beginning of the hour and the potential legal troubles that might be coming for the administration. Also, you know, I think it's important to think about what General Kelly's departure means for the administration. We were just talking about immigration, and, well, you know, it's important to remember that the Democrats actually offered Trump $20 billion for border wall construction in exchange for securing DACA legislatively. Mm-hmm. And the president initially agreed to the deal, and then the reports are that Chief of Staff Kelly then went up to him, and Kelly is a, you know, sort of noted restrictionist, and told President Trump that no, he couldn't do that. And other sort of immigration restrictionists within the administration followed suit, and then, you know, Trump backed off the deal. And so it may be the case that a new chief of staff, it may temper the president in some of these ways. So we'll have to see.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about John Kelly's legacy, Jonathan? We've heard various stories. I'm sure you've read a lot of the analysis about it. John Kelly from the military there, serving, I guess, this he would be the longest chief of staff, right?
That's right. You know, it's I don't think Kelly's legacy is a terribly successful one. I mean, I think you'd be hard-pressed to sort of point to any particular accomplishment that Kelly has done. Clearly, he and the president have clashed. I mean, some of it seems to be personality differences. Some of it seems to be Kelly's attempts to, you know, perhaps maneuver Trump or to make sure that the president doesn't, I don't know, commit himself to, you know, impulsive and potentially illegal actions. And so this is a very difficult job. I mean, it's a difficult job in the best of times. But, you know, the president seems to, in some ways, want to serve as his own chief of staff. And, you know, he's a man who famously doesn't like control, right? He famously wants to be in charge. And so, you know, finding a replacement is going to be very, very tricky. You're going to have someone who is willing to deal with presidential outbursts while also, you know, shepherding potential legislation through Congress and dealing, of course, with a newly empowered group of House Democrats who have subpoena power and could come after the administration on a whole host of scandals, real and imagined. And so, you know, despite the president's optimistic tweets that he's got lots of people looking for this, it seems to be very difficult for him to find someone. Apparently, his first choice for this, Nick Ayers, the vice president's current chief of staff, was, you know, turned him down, almost publicly turned him down. This apparently caught the president off guard.
There was even a speech written announcing that he was going to take the position. I believe they'd gone that far, and then
they were turned down. And they were turned down, exactly. So, you know, this is going to be tough. I would also just very briefly like to point to the irony that Trump, when he was still a private citizen, tweeted a few years ago that the fact that President Obama went through three chiefs of staff in his time in office was a result of failure. I suspect we won't hear about that again.
All right. Last few minutes we have here, I certainly want to get your views on the sort of surprise, I guess, Mitch McConnell taking the Senate floor in a shift, said that they would take up this long-awaited bipartisan bill, which aims to reduce the number of people in our nation's crowded prisons, the criminal justice reform legislation that I think stretches way back to the Obama era. Let's hear what Majority Leader McConnell had to say in announcing this.
In addition, at the request of the president and following improvements to the legislation that have been secured by several members, the Senate will take up the recently revised criminal justice bill this month. I intend to turn to the new text as early as the end of this week. So as a result of this additional legislative business, members should now be prepared to work between Christmas and New Year's, if necessary, in order to complete our work.
Okay, what do you make of this, Renee? Possible extension of the lame duck session, McConnell there. How did this get to the agenda? All of a sudden, the stars aligning, perhaps, because, as I said, a version of this, I think a very similar version, goes back to the Obama administration, in which McConnell didn't let it come to the floor, right?
Yeah, and the reason for Senator McConnell's switch is not something that I'm aware of. The votes, he's right, the votes are there, but the votes have been there for a very long time, and it's a very broad coalition where you have senators as disparate as Rand Paul from Kentucky to Cory Booker of New Jersey, all supporting this proposal for different reasons. Mm-hmm. The president, as I said earlier, has also been pretty sympathetic to this, the idea of lowering mandatory minimums, giving judges increased discretion in sentencing. And the future seems pretty optimistic. And a lot of people would, I think, consider this an actually very significant legislative accomplishment. One of the things that's sort of difficult, again, to understand is how this fits with his recent appointment for or nominee for the position of attorney general, which mm-hmm. is somebody who would seem to be sort of very ideologically opposed to this type of reform.
Mm-hmm. What's your view on this, Jonathan? I mean, we now have the president, according to the majority leader, asking that this come to the floor during this lame duck session. Of course, candidate Trump very much campaigning on a harsh law and order charge, wasn't he?
Yeah, he did. I mean, of course, this president is famously transactional, and so it may be that he's looking to get something out of this, or maybe he believes in the issue. It seems to me, you know, I'm also not privy to Mitch McConnell's thoughts on why he is choosing to bring this up for a vote, but it seems to me that our own Senator Grassley played a large part in this. He is, of course,
yes,
chair of the Judiciary Committee. He's been pushing this issue for a long time, and recently, over the past couple of weeks, he's made a number of sort of very negative comments about Mitch McConnell's not allowing this to be brought for a vote. And mm-hmm. so it may well be that Grassley's public complaints are what is bringing this forward now.
Mm. Some of the specifics, and we'll devote, I'm sure, hours to this in the future in 2019, if this is indeed a happening thing that will do it. I mean, a measure that would, according to reports, give judges more discretion in sentencing offenders for nonviolent crimes, particularly drug offenses, I think, Renee, right? Bolstering rehabilitation, mm-hmm. so sort of edging towards rehabilitation rather than harsh punishment is what we're looking at, and trying to reduce the numbers in our prisons.
Yeah, and criminologists who have studied this have talked for years about the negative effects on the war on drugs on communities of color, on socioeconomically deprived communities, and the federal policy in this area has moved towards increasingly punitive areas since the 1990s. If you just look at the size of the federal inmate population, it has gone up and up and up and up and up and up. And then finally, in around the early 2000s, plateaued because we hit some kind of capacity in terms of the basic, you know, size of our federal penal system. And so the idea of actually scaling down significantly is a reversal from a direction that we've been on since really the Nixon administration.
Mm-hmm. In the final couple minutes we have with you, Renee and Jonathan, that's probably our last discussion in 2018, looking to 2019. Of course, it'll be a primary season, and we'll soon be saying it's a year until the Iowa caucuses here. I'd like to have you finish by each of you giving us your thoughts on, let's look at the Democrats. I mean, we could talk about the challenge perhaps to Donald Trump as the nominee, but let's talk about the Democrats because we have limited time. A lot of names, Beto O'Rourke in there along with Joe Biden in a move-on poll I saw there too. Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Sherrod Brown, Amy Klobuchar. Jonathan, what are your thoughts with so many Democratic candidates out there vying to be the nominee?
Sure. Well, this was a poll done by Move On, of course, the very left organization. And, you know, even though Beto O'Rourke came in first in this poll, I think he only got something like 15% of the vote. Mm-hmm. And so it shows that there isn't a clear Democratic leader, right? There's a lot of, you know, the sort of Bernie talk seems to have faded, perhaps because he's not a young man, and of course he's gotten older since 2016. Essentially, there's no Democratic standout here, right? We don't know who's going to emerge from the field, and it's clear that at least the left side of the party wants somebody younger, somebody dynamic, but you know, no one has settled yet on who that may be, and so we're likely to be in for a real kind of a food fight going forward, I think.
Okay, just less than a minute to go. Rene, your thoughts as we close this program.
Yeah, well, I'm really interested to see what happens with the Better Work candidacy if he decides to run. I'm a native Texan, so I was following his Senate race from very early on before it really caught national attention. And the type of mobilization that you saw in that state, where he came within 3 points of Senator Cruz, was, you know, really amazing. And the way he did it, by still keeping a pretty leftist sort of message, is fascinating, and how that plays nationally, mm-hmm. I'll be interested to see.
Do you believe the speculation that had he been more moderate in his views, he could have taken Cruz?
I think that part of his brand is not being that, so I'm not sure that he could have maybe mobilized to the same degree.
Political discussions to continue on to next week and into 2019, when Jonathan Hasid and Rene Rocha will certainly be with us as part of our stable of political expertise here in Iowa. Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University, Rene Rocha, thank you very much. Rene of University of Iowa. We appreciate your time, Jonathan and Rene.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.